Von unten im Gespräch. Diskussionen, Interviews, Gesprächsrunden zu aktuellen Themen. Eine Sendung der Nachrichtenredaktion von Radio Helsinki.
Herzlich willkommen bei Von unten im Gespräch. Am Mikrofon grüßt euch heute Daniel, gerade zu Besuch in Graz und für euer freies Radio am Start. Heute hört ihr den letzten Teil der Sendereihe Wir wollen uns lebend. Vivas nos queremos. Transnationale Debatten, Theorien und Gegenstrategien zu Feminiziden und patriarchaler Gewalt. Seide Mobayet-Vega, aktuell PhD-Kandidatin in Soziologie an der Universität Cambridge, bespricht in ihrem Vortrag die Relevanz der Datenerhebung von Feminiziden sowie Problematiken eingehend auf die Situation in Mexiko. Sie erklärt, wie zivile Datenerhebung eine Form des Aktivismus darstellt und eine bedeutende Basis der Daten zu Feminiziden bildet.
The seminar on the topics of feminicide. We are very delighted to have Saide Mobayet-Vega with us today, a dedicated researcher and PhD candidate in sociology at the University of Cambridge. We sincerely thank you for taking the time to be here and share your research interests, insights with us. This lecture is part of the second section of the seminar addressing feminicide and patriarchal violence. The first section was held in Innsbruck and focused on controversies, media coverage, and statistics related to feminicides. Our discussions revolved around the systematic issue of gender-based violence, encompassing both physical and mental aspects. Some definitions classify an act as femicide when violence based on gender results in death. The seminar has explored approaches to reduce the high global feminicide rates. Similar to other methods, the practice of counting deaths and making these figures public has advantages and disadvantages. Risks such as the repercussions of data gaps, decontextualization, and the potential shift of focus from the victims we already presented. Now, with Saide Mobayet-Vega, who sees the importance of counting visibility and evidence-based policymaking. We now have an expert in data activism, well-versed in the benefits of this practice. Now, Helena will introduce the speaker now.
Saide Mobayet-Vega, a dedicated researcher and PhD candidate in sociology at the University of Cambridge, navigates the intricate intersection of human rights, violence against women, digital technologies, and data in her scholarly pursuits. Her research illuminates the narrative of feminicide, examining its portrayal across various scales by closely scrutinizing global practices of data collection and local data activism, with a specific emphasis on the Mexican context. At the forefront of addressing gender-based violence, Saide co-founded the Feminicide Watch platform in collaboration with the UN Studies Association in 2017. Within the academic field, Saide's PhD dissertation at the University of Cambridge delves into the conceptualization and quantification of feminicide, particularly exploring its evolution across time and spaces. With a keen focus on Mexico, her research endeavors contribute significantly to our understanding of the complexities surrounding feminicide. So this was the speaker's introduction, and now we are ready for the lecture. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Carla and Helena, for the kind introduction, and thank you to Lillian as well for the invitation. I am delighted to be with you here today. Some technicalities I'd like to address before starting. I know you're all very familiar with the topic, but this lecture will cover gender-based violence. So if anything I mention here triggers you, please feel free to leave the room and come back when you feel it's safe for you to do so. On March 8, 2022, in the frame of the International Women's Day, a remarkable Zeppelin cruised the skies of Mexico City. The gray floating machine, which you can see now on your screen, carried two simple yet powerful messages addressing violence against women and girls. On one side, it stated, 10 feminicidios diarios, 10 feminicides daily. And conversely, it affirmed, ninguna en el olvido, none in oblivion. Images and videos documenting the dirigible's journey were posted on X, formerly known as Twitter, under the hashtag, feministas toman el cielo de México, feminists take the sky of Mexico. In previous years, the government had prevented feminists' attempts to condemn violence against women and girls by implementing robust fencing measures and thus restricting and controlling their interaction around Mexico City's downtown area. Outraged, this time the protesters a pressing need to name, categorize, and count feminicide to demand justice and accountability for the victims has grown exponentially. The daily count of feminicide, as the Zeppelin intervention suggests, stands as a bulwark against oblivion. Yet, despite the growing efforts by global institutions such as the UN and national governments to improve statistical data on feminicide, they remain imprecise, inaccurate, incomplete, inexistent, or inexplicable. The reasons behind these obstacles are complex, manifold, and contextually situated. Scholars and experts have pointed to the inexorable intricacies of violence, unstable standardization of the crimes at the federal level, rampant impunity, scarce resources, tenuous political will, and the difficulties of proving gender as a motivation for the crime. Angered by a paucity of official data, which is the one produced by governments, citizens worldwide use digital tools, platforms, and methods to recount what has been labeled as missing data or counter data against feminicide. Today, we will situate and explore these practices together. And theoretically, I will draw on insights from digital sociology, critical data studies, and data feminism. And at the core, I won't dig much into the theoretical framework, but I just want you folks to be aware that at the core of these epistemologies is questioning the processes by which social phenomena become measurable and quantifiable. How do we translate a social thing into a number, that being death in this case? Data are not something simply out there to be discovered, but are co-constituted and co-produced in socio-material and technopolitical practices. In other words, data are never raw, but always cooked, as Geoffrey Boker reminds us. Hence, we should ask who is included in these metrics, how and why. And we will empirically cover this with when I present my 2 years of empirical work on different grassroots practices recounting feminicide in Mexico, but I have also studied how the UN is collecting feminicide data and how the Mexican state is collecting feminicide data. So, but today we'll only cover the activist side of it. So very briefly, because I know you're very familiar with the topic as you've been having the seminars, but it's important for me to cover briefly what is femicide and feminicide. It's the gender-related killing of women and girls, the crucial difference wrought by this category in comparison to intentional female homicide is the role of gender as a motivation of the crime. So gender remains at the core of the definition of feminicide. You know about the origins and about the evolution, how it repoliticized in Mexico, so I won't dig further into this. However, although used interchangeably, I use feminicide in my work, not only given the focus on Mexico, but also because I agree that the state is always, to an extent, responsible for the killing of women and girls. Also, and here I'm taking this from Fragoso and Bejarano, which book you can see on your screen now, feminicide underscores the discursive and material contributions and perspectives of transborder feminist thinkers from the global south that have given to this definition. Choosing feminicide further implies a political decision to center theories originating in the global south, and here they draw on Mignolo, which seeks to dismantle the colonial understanding of Latin America as a site of study rather than one of theory making. The UN, primarily through UN Women and UNODC, has also actively engaged in counting, measuring, and defining feminicide. And in the recent statistical framework for measuring gender-related killing of women and girls, they provide us with a clear definition of what gender-related motivation is. And I find this very important because it has a very concise rippling effect in how we count feminicide. So the consensus is that gender-related motivation is defined as the root causes, such as stereotype gender roles, discrimination towards women and girls, inequality, and unequal power relations between women and men in society, that characterize the specific context in which the killings take place. And it's also worth noting that to date, only the Latin American region has included feminicide or femicide in their legislation and criminal codes. So currently 18 countries have this within their institutional data making. And what this framework, the statistical framework by UNODC does is to set parameters to count feminicide despite or regardless of legislation proceedings. I also want to point you folks, if you're interested in knowing more about data collection practices beyond the ones that we'll cover today in the handbook that I recently co-edited, you can find 3 chapters that address how governments, international organizations, observatories, and activists are counting feminicide. So just in case you want to know further. So counting feminicide in Mexico, and I'm not going to explore this in depth because it's rather a complex topic, and I'm more interested about how counting is being resisted, contested, and new forms are emerging from civil society. Yet it's worth providing you with the context with what the Mexican state is doing to count and measure feminicide. And I take most of the insight from that chapter we co-wrote in the handbook. And the crime of femicide and feminicidal violence were included in the Federal Criminal Code in 2012 in Mexico. However, given Mexico's federal particularities, and it's worth noting the political system that the country has, it wasn't until 2020 that the 32 states included feminicide as a crime. And each state's definition of gender-based reasons slightly varies. So what the outcome of this is that what might be considered a feminicide in Querétaro, which is a state in Mexico, might not be considered a feminicide in Zacatecas. So this to say that in Mexico, we have currently a lot of challenges to provide longitudinal data. And sometimes the media also contributes to exacerbate the problem by saying in a certain state, feminicide rates have increased 100% in the last 5 years, say. And one ought to question whether that is the case or whether the state actually started to count feminicide in the last few years. So it's incredibly complex to provide a longitudinal comparison across the years on feminicide, and more so because of how different the definitions are. So today we have two primary official sources assessing feminicide in Mexico. One is administrative data on open files on alleged feminicide from the state attorney's offices. And this is published monthly by the Executive Secretariat of the Public Security National System, which we tend to say in Spanish, El Secretariado, and the mortality statistics produced by the Department of Health and processed by INEGI, which is our National Institute of Statistics. So we have these two sources. One measures feminicide based on an investigation file that's been opened as a feminicide as a crime. And the other one does not measure feminicide. So INEGI does not measure feminicide, but rather intentional homicide. So these sources are kind of discordant in the way they measure feminicide, in the way they define feminicide, and in the metadata available for us researchers and civil society in general to gauge the extent of the phenomenon. So a couple of things worth noting in terms of the difference is that, for example, the Secretariado, which you can see on your left now, the graph that you can see on your left, only started introducing feminicide as a crime to be measured in 2015. So that's the earliest we can see changes and variations. However, INEGI's been documenting mortality data since 85, really. So researchers point to INEGI's data, which although do not measure feminicide as such, as the data source that could approximate us closer to the extent of feminicide. And in order for us to know what from this whole data set, you know, because they have intentional female homicide, what of this huge data set is actually feminicide, you need to open their metadata and see some of the variables. The mortality dataset has 59 variables. And for instance, the variable that is related to intimate, so to perpetrator-victim relationship is crucial for us to know whether that killing was gender motivated. However, and this is kind of crazy when you think about it, organizations such as Data Civica and Intersecta show how this variable remains unspecified in 98.4 homicides of men and 96.3 homicides of women that occurred between 2012 and 2019. So there is a lot of underreporting, a lot of missing data that prevents us from actually knowing what is happening. And another limitation that we have, and this is from the data coming from the Secretariado, which is the investigation file, is that this changed with time. So say an investigation file was opened as alleged feminicide, but then the investigation closed and said, this woman actually committed suicide. So that will have an impact on the pattern and measurements of femicide in previous years. And another hindrance of the Secretariado database is that what they count is the number of investigation files opened, which means that if there was a case that had four women being killed, the numbers would only count as one because they're counting investigation files and not bodies. So this is a not yet another problem that we have with the current data in Mexico. So to summarize this section, despite Mexican state's efforts to document and measure feminicide, which have increased drastically in the last 10 years, data remains incomplete, inconsistent, inexplicable, and at times in certain municipalities, completely lacking. The screen shows a Gmail account with dozens of Google Alert emails being opened in different tabs. News articles with unpalatable headlines that have the words woman, killed, death, disposed, plastic bag, start to populate the Chrome window I'm just seeing. Hi, says the voice in the video. Well, this is the first preview into how I do my daily feminicide monitoring, says the audio. I am taking from a year into a month into a specific case of a woman whose body was found in a waste lot inside a rubbish plastic bag. She was 27 years old. Through clicks, screenshots, and various news and Facebook links, Yvonne Ramirez describes step-by-step the process of building the database that will populate the map of Ciudad Juárez with feminicides in the shape of blue pins. This accountability feels like unraveling a spool of thread, or as if a matryoshka doll is being opened, each time taking me into a smaller scale of details. What I just shared with you now is an excerpt of one of the diaries Yvonne Ramirez, a Mexican feminist activist, sent to me in the frame of my PhD empirical data collection. You can see a video of my screen navigating through Yvonne's project, which is titled Ellas Tienen Nombre, They Have a Name, a digital map that locates feminicides in Ciudad Juárez from 1993 to date. Feminicide here is recounted as pins, as red pins, as you can see on the screen, but also through infographics, videos, and photos taken from news articles and social media. Ellas Tienen Nombre seek to reinstate not just that these women have a name, but to rename them through the act of remembering. So what is data activism? A decade ago, Stefania Milan and Miren Gutierrez were pioneers in defining data activism as that which uses digital technologies and data infrastructures as a method to mobilize and communicate its objectives, which often seek to expose or reveal what was possibly unseen or named or what is missing. Furthermore, in the last couple of years, Catherine D'Ignacio has remarkably delved into data-making practices against feminicide, leading to her upcoming book, Counting Feminicide, Data Feminism in Action, which you can access online. And since 2020, together with Silvana Fumega and Elena Suarez, they have designed multilateral activities around feminicide data. And you can see more in their website if you're interested. So in this book, Catherine D'Ignacio does a really fantastic job at defining what missing data is and why it is relevant for activists. So missing data is considered to be the twin of official data, and it's defined as those that are neglected to be prioritized, collected, maintained, and published by institutions, despite political demands that such data should be collected and made available. Missing data are either a lack of contextual information from documented records or is totally absent. And indeed, there is missing data in official data about feminicide precisely because grassroots feminists, indigenous, Black, queer, and women's groups and social media movements make demands that such data be produced. So projects that fit into a data activism approach have been significant in accounting for the killings that tend not to make official data, such as trans women, women of color, Black women, migrant women, indigenous women, and so on. So who is recounting feminicide data? How are they doing it, and why are they doing it? We would not be naming and counting feminicide had it not been for the relentless activism of feminists, families, and civil society. This echoes what Catherine D'Ignacio writes in her book. It has been through social activism that we have this data available. It's pushing and the active leverage of families, of feminist movements that have made us aware of the need to collect this data. And interestingly, Esther Chavez Cano, the woman that you see on the left, was to my knowledge, the first activist to monitor, document, and generate numerical data on feminicides in Mexico back in 1993, when she was a journalist at the time at a newspaper in Ciudad Juárez, and she started to notice this pattern of women being killed. So she started to collect analogly with scissors and the printed press, the cases of hundreds of what then became hundreds of women who started to appear in the barren Chihuahuan desert, mutilated, killed, disposed, etc. And given the state silence during those years, Chavez's alternative database is one of the few resources to date that records the early systematic killing of the woman in Juarez. To note, I find this incredibly interesting. It wasn't until 2020, as I said, that the 32 states in Mexico have included feminicide as a criminal category in their state criminal codes. And Chihuahua, which is the state where Ciudad Juárez is located, was the last state to include this. So it took Chihuahua 8 years to include feminicide as a crime in their criminal code, despite the incredible awareness globally that Ciudad Juárez has had with this phenomenon. The medium through which these practices are enacted has changed since Esther Chavez began to today. And data activism practices are digitally mediated, so they often use digital media, digital platforms, digital technologies, and they're communicated through interfaces such as Google Maps, for instance, that enable the exchange and interaction of information and data. Yeah, they allow us to interact with the databases. And by 2023, Elena Suarez's project Feminicidio Uruguay has documented over 90 different efforts to collect data about feminicide from civil society. It is also worth noting that it's not just in Mexico. In the last few years, I'd say it started kind of intensively in 2015, and then it peaked really high in 2018. And now there are lots of countries collecting feminicide data from civil society, Poland, Russia, Turkey. It's incredible. And they span from Excel sheets, graphs, video, and photo memorials. And Catherine D'Ignacio has cataloged more than 150 grassroots projects documenting feminicide. Thus, the digital space where these practices find meaning and infrastructure becomes really vibrant, and the vast majority take their information from news media, as I said. It's also worth noting that data, in this sense, is not just not just numbers, but also any information that is collected and categorized. So digital memorials, for example, I also consider digital memorials to be data practices, or Instagram accounts to be data practices, and I'll show them to you in a moment. Before delving a bit deeper into the practices I've explored in Mexico, I want to state two noteworthy conditions about this type of data practices produced by civil society. First, that they're mostly done voluntarily in the free time of citizens, activists, and so on. And this means there's no financial remuneration for the work that they're doing. And the second condition that is also important to stress is the effective resonance of engaging with this type of work. And this is particular to the Mexican context, given the media ecosystem and the tabloids that we have, which are called Nota Roja. I don't know if you've heard about them. They're known as yellow journalism. And these newspapers tend to represent feminicide with sensationalist headlines and graphic images that re-victimize women, their families, and their communities. They tend to be very gory. They at times tend to be a bit sarcastic. So on the one hand, such media representations provide a detailed graphic description of how, when, and where these crimes occur. But on the other hand, exposure to such gory depiction has had a detrimental impact on feminicide data producers' mental health and emotional well-being, because they're constantly reading horrendous news in order to populate their databases. And as Elena Suarez-Ball and other colleagues note, producing feminicide data is care work with, and it has emotional burden. Maintaining a database involves many hours a week of reading stories of violence and logging every detail of every case. Activists describe the media reports they must scrutinize as sensational, irresponsible, revictimizing, discriminatory, especially for trans people and women of color, dehumanizing and stigmatizing. Even so, they persist in carrying out this work not only to count feminicides, but also to sustain the memory and bear witness. And they offer this blog post, which is great, so to help activists navigate this emotional burden. So in case you're interested to know further about it, you can head there. So just to reinstate, with each feminicide, an overkilling of the subject occurs as the case becomes mediatized and the information about it is shaped and shared across different media platforms. If I were to give an analogy of how this death overspill reverberates on the internet, I would say that each time a feminicide becomes mediatized, a leak occurs, an affect amplifies. Bodies turn to drops that outflow into interfaces shaped with digital artifacts that recount for them between data sets and data stories. A leak can be a lead, as that quote that you see from Sarah Ahmed on the screen, and drops multiply, expand, and join bodies of water. In this way, I argue that rather than just counting or countering feminicide data, what these interfaces and these practices do is actually to recount the killing of women and girls as their knowledge production shifts from data sets into data stories and settings. The reason why I use recount instead of counting is twofold. And first, because data practices against feminicide never count the killing of a woman once. They do it repetitively each time they question the feasibility of the data or use a story to mobilize political action. And the second reason of why I use recount than count is linguistic, and it relates to translation. Unlike in English, where to count means to enumerate, to determine the number of something, or to include, in Spanish, contar, which is a translation, also means to tell a story. Numbers become secondary in the quest to narrate and memorialize the lives of feminicide victims. And during my empirical work, I've traced over 20 citizen data projects that recount and document feminicide in Mexico using digital technologies. As you can see on your screen now, the 20 of them are there. And I've categorized them using the type of interface, kind of producer, geographical scope, etc. And through this exploration, I've come to various analytical categories, of which I'll share three with you today. And while I'm sharing this with you, I don't know how we are with time. I think it won't take much longer for me to wrap up. You'll see how this become exemplified. So the first attribute, I'd say, or the first feature that these data practices have is that they're deliberately archival. So for activists recounting feminicide, they stress over and over and over, over again that these are not numbers, but stories to be remembered. In these databases, feminicide cases become crystallized into feminicide stories that function as mnemonic practices that both record and transmit memory. For example, the video that you're seeing now belongs to a beautiful digital memorial called Ecos en el Desierto, and it recounts the story of 8 feminicide victims, and they're retold through videos of their mothers showing around the cases and showing around news clips, their objects. And as a vivid illustration of how these practices are deliberately archival, Paula Flores Bonilla, which is the woman you're seeing on your screen now, mother of Maria Sagrario Gonzalez, a feminicide victim, I think she was killed in 93. She was one of the earliest feminicide victims in Juarez. And her story is displayed in this memorial. And she, in the video, she recalls the quote that you see there, which I think is very profound and rather beautiful. And she writes, I translated this from Spanish, and she writes, "Unfortunately, my daughter became an archive. a living file because I continue to ask for justice for Sagrario. My daughter is not dead. As long as I live and demand justice, she's still alive. She is alive, not physically, but in my heart, mind, memory, and many places. So here's precisely where we see that recounting feminicide data moves beyond counting and opens the possibilities of building heritage. It's also a form of archiving these losses. So the other feature of these practices is that they're inherently situated, and interfaces that recount feminicide data move from data sets into data settings. And this I'm taking this from Gianni Luikisas. And he has a great book called All Data Are Local. And he sort of makes the case of that all data belong to a place. And we should really question how local conditions influence data in our everyday practices. And data are often entangled within a knowledge system and inscribed in a place. And a lot of the practices that I traced and the activists that I interview are very connected to the place they're mapping. Either they're originally from that city, like Yvonne, the data snapshot that I previously shared with you. She is originally from Ciudad Juarez, and she started mapping feminicide because she said to me, you know, I left Juarez for a couple of years, and when I came back, I wanted to know where I was standing. And these practices are inherently situated as well in that, you know, the origin of the Pink Cross, which was analog, was precisely to warn women that a feminicide had been found in this specific location. So mothers, such as the video which we just saw, were painting these pink crosses in Ciudad Juarez, not just to memorialize that had been the place where a woman was killed, but to warn others that this could be a potentially dangerous place. And I find, I explore this in my work as well, how fascinating it is that the cross has translated, as you can see on your screen here, the cross translates digitally, and it also becomes a point where a body was found. So this project, which is absolutely beautiful, I really love it. It's called La Muerte Sale por el Oriente, Death Comes Out of the East, and it addresses feminicide violence in the state of Mexico through three axes. So one is Sonia documents feminist protests, so through photography, which are absolutely beautiful. And the second one that I also love is a territorial intervention in three municipalities in the state of Mexico, where she carved the mirror, the silhouette of a woman, and she placed this silhouette in places where bodies were found. So the photo that you see in the middle is the second part of her intervention. And what I find quite poetic about it is that you get to see yourself in the mirror. So it is as if data practices somehow become a form of situated mirror, where a lot of the interviewees that I interviewed said how they see themselves in these databases, how this could happen to you. And so there is this situatedness that is really particular to the Mexican context, I'd say, in comparison to ordered other data practices. And the third intervention in this project, La Muerte Sale por el Oriente, is digital mapping of feminicide cases, what you can see on your right. So she combines these three moments. And the third one that I want to share with you is that they're unpredictably relational. And as I've said, and I want to stress over and over again, interfaces do not just enumerate feminicide, they want to tell a story. So in this way, it feels as if the act of recounting is also shaping relations. And you can even see it with the artifacts, the cross or the pen in maps. They're recounting feminicide, but also connecting across the data set. So for instance, part of my work has been to trace certain cases across these interfaces and see how they're narrated differently. And I find it quite fascinating, the unpredicted connection. And I'll explain a bit more about it in a moment. It is as if there's a repetition of difference as well. And the video that you see here on your screen is Yo Te Nombro by Maria Salguero, which is probably the most famous feminicide data activist. And since its emergence, this project has gained international awards and recognition. I mean, she's been in Forbes 100 Most Powerful Influential Women list in 2020 and 2021. And Salguero started in 2016 using Google Alerts and Ushahidi software. And she's a geophysical engineer by training. And the project unfortunately stopped in 2021. So if you, it's inactive. If you go to the website, it's completely empty. But by 2020, she had recorded almost 10,000 cases. Mind you, this is a woman that does this, that did this manually, like without any machine learning or anything. And it was truly fascinating how meticulously she was categorizing feminicide and how much she began to have a better understanding of the context in which she was producing this data. So she began crafting categories such as feminicide by connection or feminicide in the frame of organized crime. So what I argue is that in Yo Te Nombro, each cross represents, despite each cross represents a specific moment in time, it also contains an entire history of patriarchal oppression. Their parts simultaneously show us a detailed presence and an overall absence of power structures, and they resonate and get distorted. They expand and reduce as we navigate through their digital wholeness. And the very first time I went to the website, I found it kind of impactful to see the geography of the country completely covered in crosses. It's kind of impactful, I find. And when I interviewed Maria in 2022, she remembered how back in 2016, she was not planning on continuing with the map because she wanted to study a master's degree in earthquake seismology. And that wish lingered with me, and it got me thinking about earthquakes, sudden, untamed, and unpredictable consequences. And the emergence of Yo Te Nombro was, after all, a seismic wave that changed the data landscape against feminicide. It inspired other data practices quite unpredictably, such as the Instagram No Estamos Todas, which I'll show you in a minute. And it further triggered the Datos Contra Feminicidio project. And also, Maria Salguero database was what inspired Catherine D'Ignacio to write that incredibly important book for this field. So I find it quite fascinating how discourses tend to ripple. And Maria, at the beginning, she had no idea. She was just doing it because she thought, I want to contribute to do something about the problem in Mexico. And then I'm about to finish because I know we need Q&A. And I want to conclude with the relational methodology of No Estamos Todas, which is this Instagram account that you see on your screen. It is a collective of graphic designers who, based on Maria Salguero's cases, so they used Maria Salguero's database, illustrate feminicide victims and upload images on Instagram. And what seems to trigger these practices is a strong will to make a change and to guarantee the memory of those uncounted insofar as they don't just look at the numbers, but rather not narrate them through the story. And what I really like about the methodology is that they do not necessarily draw women as a portrait of the woman, but the illustration has always a connection to the illustrator as well. So for instance, when there are no photos of the victim, then the illustrator imagines what she would have liked and it often echoes to what she likes. And I think that relational methodology is really profound and beautiful, and it's a great, great example of recounting. And I want to finish with this quote by Diane Nelson in her book, The Ends of War in Guatemala. And she writes this based on an interview of the aftermath of war in Guatemala. And she writes, counting offers a soothing objectivity in the facts, just the facts. But why is it that one death is a tragedy, but 200,000 are just a statistic? One counts, but it is insufficient. It is telling, context, milieu, identities that makes that one death count. Connections articulate us. It is connections that articulate us, love that makes that life breathable. And yeah, I'll finish it. Thanks.
Thank you for this great lecture and insight on your work. I think we've all learned a lot, and we would like to open the room for questions from the audience.
My question was just if the Mexican government recognizes these alternative databases in any sort of way, or if they just ignore them, I guess.
Yeah, that's a great question. Thanks. Not officially, I'd say, so they do not include this data. However, they've definitely pushed the Mexican state to improve their data collection practices, for sure. And interestingly, Maria Salguero is now working for government in Sonora. So she's one of the activists, like the most, I'd say, famous one. And then she was now hired by the government to produce better. It's connected not just with feminicide, but also with contextual violence in the state. So there is certainly a connection, yet not an official recognition of these databases. Because to be fair, none really know, we don't know the extent of feminicide just yet. You know, the activists, the only source of information they have are news reports. So a lot of domestic or intimate partner feminicide do not really reach the news media. It's more so the sensation, or no, they tend to do, but other more sensationalist feminicide tend to reach the media. So, yeah.
Thank you. So my question is, you have said that femicides have increased, or the data has, the femicides have suggested that femicides have increased. And my question is, if you think that has something to do with the data itself, so more femicides have been counted, or if that there is a connection of actually, you know, increased femicides, if you know what I mean. So, or if you can even say that, or if it's hard to evaluate that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great question. Thanks. I think this is why some organizations look at homicide data rather than just feminicide, given how unstable the metrics have been. And recently, the UN just published this, the global homicide data count. And for the first time, female homicides have actually increased, more so in comparison to male homicide, which suggests an increase. Yet when, you know, dealing with data numbers, one needs to be wary and careful of the limitations of this number. So whether it has increased or not is yet to be 100% proven, I guess. However, what has changed, though, and this is really important, is the patterns of the killings. And this is very particular to Mexico, in that, you know, in Western countries, women tend to be killed at home by their intimate partners. That is what the data is showing. Whereas in Mexico, what we've seen is that that remains the case. You know, the intimate partner killing remains quite stable, but the killing of women using firearms has really increased. And it's a pattern that's similar to male homicide. So now there are other, so it basically means that women are unsafe both in their houses and outside, or born in both in homes and outside homes. So what data is showing us is a change of trend in the pattern of killing. And a lot more women are dying now with guns than, you know, with knives or strangled and so on, which is the pattern that was often used to kill women. So, yeah.
Can I ask another question?
Yeah, sure.
I think in the beginning of your lecture, you said that in Mexico, the criminalization of feminicide was only in 2020, or was I wrong? Okay, so no. Do you also say that this criminalization, or like the framing of feminicide as a crime, also changed the way feminicides have been practiced, or the, following that, what you just said, that there's a change in the way women have been killed?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So to clarify, in 2012, it was included as a crime in the federal criminal code in Mexico. But because we're a federation, that means that each state has autonomy to include in whichever way they want, basically. So it wasn't until 2020 that the 32 states of Mexico included feminicide in their criminal code. They could have had feminicide as an aggravated of homicide, but not as a crime itself. So that gives us already challenges to compare it longitudinally. Whether data has had an influence in the patterns of the killings, I'm not entirely sure. Mostly what has had an influence in the patterns of the killings has been the war on drugs. So you can clearly see a peak of in 2009, for instance, when Calderon launched the war on drugs, the increase of access to guns was just insane. And at the moment, the militarization of the country has also exacerbated killing and the killing with guns too. So perhaps the importance here is to stress the contextual particularities. And this is why I sometimes struggle with the UN global databases, for instance, where, you know, for the sake of comparability, the context becomes just erased to an extent or reduced. That's ultimately what standards do. You know, to standardize something means to strip it away of its context so you can put it all in the same bag. So it's worth noting these contextual particularities and see why the trends in homicide have changed. And primarily, I'd say, is access to guns that has increased drastically with militarization. And, you know, we have the US at the north, so that is also very detrimental to the security of the country. And Juarez, you know, like the patterns of killing in Juarez emerged after the NAFTA agreement was signed between the US, Mexico, and Canada. So all these transnational maquiladoras moved to the northern border, and that changed sociological pattern dynamics in that space, which made women more vulnerable. And here's when we need a gender dimension to homicide and to violence, because violence does not occur the same for everyone. It varies and changes depending on your intersectionality. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks for your questions.
And we'll take one of our questions with Beth. Our question was, what are steps that have to be taken in order to raise more awareness on this topic? Because we still feel like this is a very not really public topic, and was more awareness and change.
This is a great question. I think with everything, one needs to look at the context. So awareness again is very situated, and I'd say for the Mexican case in particular, you know, each time they ask, "Oh, why do we still have women being killed in such brutal ways?" And you know, there's been more attention to data collection, but has that actually reduced feminicide? And the answer would actually be no. they haven't necessarily reduced, or you know, we haven't really stopped them at all. And that to say that awareness requires a very multi-dimensional perspective. And it needs to be in the media, it needs to be in education, it needs to be in the cultural production of the country, it needs to be in the rule of law, it needs to be tackled against impunity. So it's so complicated, really, to fully eradicate the extent of violence. And if you do not provide opportunities for people, you know, to see other realities, like, I think the reason why I like to stress the contextual particularity, say, in comparison to Germany, is that the extent of impunity in Mexico, it's huge. It's really big. So justice is accessed insofar as you're white, as you're middle class. You know, if you're a poor peripheral woman in Ciudad Juarez and you're killed, like I've talked to mothers, and like the request for justice is just paramount. And we need to tackle, like, awareness needs to be tackled in many fronts: media, political will, education. And it's something that takes time. If you go to someone and say, "Oh, you have all these gender biases," you go to a judge and you say, "Oh, you have all these gender biases in the way in which you're prosecuting a case," they'll be like, "Yeah, but it's like this Gramscian say, if you don't change hearts and minds, it won't really do anything." No, that makes sense. So it's something that would need time and will, a lot of will, political will. And it's, you know, citizens need to ask for that will as well, from our politicians and our decision makers.
Thank you for the answer to all these questions. And thank you for this lecture again. We've come to an end with our time. But we would like to thank you for your time for us. And,
great. Thanks so much for the invitation. Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you.
Damit sind wir am Ende unserer heutigen Von unten im Gesprächssendung angelangt. Ihr habt die letzte Folge der Sondersendereihe Wir wollen uns lebend, Vivas nos queremos, gehört. Das war's für heute. Am Mittwoch hört ihr um 17 Uhr wie gewohnt das Von unten Nachrichtenmagazin und am Donnerstag die Stimmlagen, das österreichweite Magazin der Freien Radios. Aus dem Studio verabschiedet sich Daniel. Wir hören uns.
Wir hören uns.
Das war Von unten im Gespräch, eine Sendung der Nachrichtenredaktion von Radio Helsinki.